Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll hear more about community colleges. Enrollment is down again this fall across the state. What are some possible solutions for the future? The process of redistricting can help a political party, but it can also come at the expense of some communities. We'll hear more. We'll also have the story of Mercy Hospital in Chicago, what it tells us about the state of healthcare. You may have noticed it's getting harder to get certain items. That's being blamed on the supply chain disruption.
The containers that are backed up at the ports, merchandise just sitting there on boats and on land that can't get to anywhere.
We'll learn how some small businesses are being affected and how a town is fighting back against the opioid fentanyl in an effort to save lives. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, the oldest hospital in Chicago, how it's an example of problems in the healthcare industry. We'll hear from a congressman in Illinois who, after months of speculation, has decided to run for another term. What was behind his decision? And farmers and environmentalists are at odds again over a controversial federal rule change. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. The disruption in the global supply chain has been hitting small businesses and entrepreneurs in Illinois and elsewhere hard. They say they're having a difficult time getting goods, supplies are more expensive, and shipping costs are on the rise. That's translated to higher prices for consumers like you. In Chicago, Claudia Morrell brings us this report.
Barry Phillips owns Affordable Portables. He sells
furniture, tables, chairs, bookcases, futons, sofas, entertainment centers.
I spoke to him earlier this month inside the Lincoln Park store his family has owned since the 1970s. It's a small shop on Clark Street. He says what's happening now, the disruption in the global supply chain prompted by labor shortages, snarled ports, and the ongoing pandemic, is unprecedented.
I haven't seen anything like this in 45 years. The containers that are backed up at the ports, merchandise just sitting there on boats and on land that can't get to anywhere.
Phillips says he's been having a rough time importing his goods from overseas, and the costs have gone way up. The cost of a container went from $4,000 to $22,000.
People that ordered sofas that used to take that I used to have immediately, or 2 or 3 days, or 4 to 6 weeks, are now taking 6 months to a year.
He says he's had to raise prices and points to a sofa in the corner. He says he's had to mark up by $150. Phillips isn't alone.
Small businesses are just having a tremendously difficult time getting the supplies that they need to run their business. And of course, this is even more concerning with the holiday season approaching.
Elliot Richards is the president of the Small Business Advocacy Council. He says the supply chain problems are impacting all kinds of retailers.
We've heard a lot about it from restaurants, from, you know, folks who sell t-shirts, from embroidery businesses, you know, really from businesses who are consumer facing, who need to serve food, get product out to their customers.
Even business owners who don't have physical storefronts but rely on imports to make their products here locally are having a tough time.
I can't find fabric. It's hard to find fabric.
That's Jennifer Atkins. She founded the Jenny Cap Company. They make head garments, which are sold at big box retailers. About 200,000 units during a normal year. This year, though, she says she probably won't be able to fill all her orders. When she says she's having a hard time finding materials, she's not kidding.
Very, very slim pickings, colors of fabric, types of fabric, colors of thread.
Atkins says the stuff she does find is really expensive. Like the price per yard of basic jersey material, you know, what most t-shirts are made of, went from $5 and change to nearly $11 a yard.
It's a double misery quotient because not only are things higher, there's less of it.
It's unclear how long these supply chain issues will last. After all, it's a confluence of events that has created this mess of global trade. Nicole DeHoratius, an adjunct professor of operations management at the University of Chicago, puts it this way.
My guess is that it's largely prompted by the pandemic, and that once we kind of get to normal labor conditions, normal demand conditions, that the supply chain can recover.
But there's no clear prediction for when that will happen. For now, DeHoratius has some advice for consumers like you.
We have to recognize that the lack of variety that we're seeing in some of the stores is intentional, and it's good for the system. So be patient and kind to your retailers at this point.
Claudia Morell with that report. The Flash Index rose a tenth of a point in November to 105.5. The University of Illinois economist Fred Gertz, who puts together the index, says the monthly guide to the Illinois economy shows it's in pretty good shape. But he says it comes too soon to tell what economic impact the new COVID-19 Omicron variant might have.
That adds to the uncertainty about the future. No one knows whether it's going to be worse or better than the Delta, but right now it's sort of an open question. So it tells us where we are. It doesn't really tell us where we're going in terms of the index.
Gertz says the Illinois economy could also be affected in coming months by inflation and continued supply chain problems. The Flash Index is based on Illinois tax receipts, all of which were up slightly in November compared to a year ago. Any number above 100 shows economic growth. A former Illinois state worker named in an infamous email about a possible rape cover-up is speaking out for the first time. Dave McKinney has that story.
Before you hear from that former state worker, you have to know Michael McLean. He was one of the most powerful people in Springfield. He was a lobbyist who was the key advisor to Michael Madigan, the former Illinois House Speaker. Last year, WBEZ found and published an email McLean wrote in 2012 to the then-governor's top aides. In it, McLean sought leniency for a state worker facing discipline. As attributes, McLean wrote that the worker had, quote, kept his mouth shut about possible ghost payrolling and a rape in Champaign. The story shook Springfield. When WBEZ confronted McLean at a Chicago steakhouse last year, he wouldn't say what the rape reference meant.
I'd prefer not to comment right now, but thank you. It's nothing against you guys. You're doing your professional job, but I'd prefer not to.
Now the man who allegedly kept his mouth shut is speaking out. Forrest Ashby was a political friend of McLean's, and he tells WBEZ it's a mystery to him what McLean was talking about.
No, I didn't know anything about a rape in Champaign prior to that email coming out. Not in Champaign, but anywhere.
McLean used to lobby for ComEd. He's now awaiting trial on federal corruption charges tied to the power company's bribery-fueled lobbying operation that was built around trying to influence Madigan. And Ashby said he didn't learn about McLean's rape and champagne comment until McLean himself told him as WBEZ was preparing to publish it. Ashby says the uproar it's created has been
terrible. It's embarrassing to me and my family and to my friends. I live in a small town, and the way that email was put together, it's like I condoned a rape cover-up and a ghost payroll cover-up. It's been devastating to me.
A slew of investigations have ensued, but no one has been charged. Ashby agreed to a recorded conversation with WBEZ in March 2020 on the condition it not be broadcast or published. Last week, Ashby agreed to lift that lid. McLean's defense lawyer declined to comment about Ashby's remarks Wednesday, but Ashby says the former clout-heavy lobbyist owes him an explanation. They were friends, after all.
That's the million-dollar question. He can't explain himself fast enough.
This is Dave McKinney.
Mercy Hospital, the oldest hospital in Chicago, was a safety net facility that treated mostly low-income elderly and black patients. It was hemorrhaging money and staff and eventually closed this year, until getting rescued in the 11th hour for just a dollar. Kristen Schorsch with member station WBEZ spent a year documenting what happened to Mercy, and we have an excerpt from her series.
What's it? That's my gin and tonic.
It's Memorial Day, close to midnight, and the scene in the parking lot of Chicago's historic Mercy Hospital is like a tailgate party. Music is blaring. There's a table heavy with food, drinks all around,
I think it's just pink lemonade.
Dr. Adele Cobbs, who helped lead Mercy's ER, takes a sip.
No, it's not just pink lemonade.
Stiff drinks aside, this isn't just any tailgate. It's more of a wake or a celebration of life. A toast to Mercy, Chicago's oldest charter hospital. In the crowd are nurses, doctors, technicians. It's a family, and they've come to say goodbye. Because within the hour, a new owner takes over. And Cobbs and hundreds of other employees are not sticking around.
It just wasn't going to be Mercy. There was no signs of Mercy in this plan. So, you know, Mercy's not a building. It's the people.
She points to the building where she grew up and says how much she's intertwined in this community, how Mercy is home. But just 30 minutes after we spoke, that would change for good. This is the story of how Mercy disappeared. In July of last year, in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, Mercy's leaders delivered a jolt. The hospital would close in 2021. Ultimately, it would get bought in the 11th hour. But until then, Mercy would slowly fade away as the community it served battled to save it.
All we hear every day is people doing press conferences where Black Lives Matter is coming out of their mouth. When it counts, our lives really don't matter.
As a so-called safety net hospital, Mercy treated mostly poor, elderly, and Black patients in an area where health disparities raged.
As an OB that's serving the community, I see the lack of care for these patients.
Today's story is about more than just a hospital going under. It's a window into why healthcare is so unequal, into the struggle to provide treatment to the people who need it most.
Unless we change the underlying medical system in this country, these hospitals cannot survive because we set up a structure that makes it impossible.
Mercy has a rich legacy. It was about 170 years old and survived the Great Chicago Fire. It trained generations of doctors and treated lots of famous patients, from Teddy Roosevelt to Muhammad Ali. And so many people who work there say it was a special place. Dr. John Patterson was an OBGYN who spent 45 years at Mercy.
And back then, you know, everybody, it was like a big family, really. Everybody would have a wonderful party. So, you got a chance to know everybody in the hospital.
It's where Patterson met his wife. Many employees have these deep connections. Mercy is where they were born. It's where they and their own families and friends go when they get sick. Dr. Alan Jackson was a cardiologist at Mercy who grew up across the street, skateboarding in the shadow of the hospital as a kid.
I mean, I might have a guy from Streets and Sands, Bridgeporter, who may be related to one of the politicians. I may have someone from Chinatown that speaks a dialect called Tai Chinese, which is rare. We have nurses who can speak that. We have Latino patients, and then we have our Black population. So you just see a slice of real Chicago at Mercy.
But here's another reality. The South Side is a healthcare desert where people have dramatically less access to care than in whiter, richer parts of Chicago. There's a severe drought of physicians, even though people who live here tend to get sicker and die younger. So Mercy was an oasis, but safety nets like it are bleeding money. They're losing patients. And the ones who do show up often have no insurance, or the insurance they do have doesn't nearly cover the cost to treat them. That puts these hospitals in the worst position to provide care to the most vulnerable people. You can hear how frustrating this is to those who've worked there, like John Patterson.
The reason that there's a problem with safety nets is because the people that live in the safety nets, you know. The problem is that Black and brown people are not valued. Our lives are not valued.
And when safety nets cut services or close, the people left behind feel abandoned, like these hospitals just didn't try hard enough.
I actually thought I was going to die, and I owe my life to Mercy Hospital. If they close Mercy, then where would I be?
92-year-old Dolores Wilson lives less than a mile from the hospital. She was treated there last spring when her intestines became inflamed. When the pain came back a few weeks later, she called an ambulance.
And I said, well, just take me to Mercy. They said, we can't take you to Mercy. I said, but I was at Mercy before. They said, we cannot take you to Mercy. They're closed or whatever. I said, no, they're not. I was there just a few weeks ago.
Mercy's ER was so short of nurses that paramedics for months had been taking patients to other hospitals. That created a domino effect. Wilson says she waited 14 hours in another hospital's packed ER. Finally, she got frustrated and left without ever seeing a doctor. Mercy turned down all of our interview requests. So we spent some time in another Southside Safety Net hospital, one that's wrestling with the same issues.
I'm Yolanda Penny. I'm the director of nursing here at St. Bernard's. I've been here 29 years.
It's mid-July, and Penny is showing me around. St. Bernard is in Englewood, about 5 miles south of Mercy.
Okay, we're going to go to the emergency room. Oh, Mr. Holland's there. Please be patient with us. We're doing a little reconstruction in our ED.
The emergency department is like a hospital's front door, but over the sound of construction, Penny tells me she doesn't have nearly enough nurses to work it.
So I'll give you an example. Tonight I'm challenged. I have 4 nurses scheduled. I should have 9.
When the pandemic hit last year, many nurses left for private agencies that paid in some cases 6 times more than St. Bernard.
It's sometimes debilitating where there are those of us who come in and help work just to make sure they can get through the day.
I catch up with Penny later. She says overnight the ER was full. There was a patient who was shot multiple times, a sick baby, a woman who said she'd already been to 3 other ERs, and 2 of them were so slammed people were waiting outside in lawn chairs. So Penny, the director of nursing, scrubbed up and went to work as an ER nurse.
We as Safety Net Hospitals are here to serve as a community, to make sure that they stay safe. But as far as resources, we do not have those.
The struggles have been much the same at Mercy. And last year, leaders there said they had reached a breaking point. The hospital was losing at least $4 million a month. Mercy's owners tried, but failed, to save the hospital with a $1 billion merger. So in July of 2020, they announced the hospital would close this year. There was immediate outrage. What would happen to patients if this oasis, in this healthcare desert, disappeared? Here's Dr. John Patterson again.
So basically, you're releasing these patients and you really don't have any place for them to land. It's like pushing them out of a plane without a parachute.
Over the next several months, it would be a long fall. I'm Kristen Schorsch in Chicago.
We have more to come on Statewide. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Just ahead, how one community is raising awareness of a dangerous drug. Up next, the Biden administration is looking to redefine what a body of water is. That definition matters. It drives the federal rules landowners have to follow. Jonathan Aul with Harvest Public Media reports the upcoming changes are putting farmers and environmentalists at odds.
Chris Brundick farms 450 acres in south central Missouri, raising hogs and cattle and growing soybeans and corn. We're in his truck on a rainy fall day. Behind us are acres and acres of soybeans. In front of us is a ditch that has a couple of inches of water in it.
This is hardly a creek, and this, in my opinion, should not be classified as a water of the U.S.
Brundick says under the Obama administration, this ditch was classified as a water of the United States. That limited what he could do on the land next to it. The Trump administration reversed that rule, making only a fraction of rivers, streams, wetlands, and creeks like Brundick's part of the definition. Brundick is worried the Biden administration will set rules that will put it and other minor creeks back into the definition, and that could reduce the amount of crops he can grow and make food more expensive. Brundick might have to use less fertilizer and weed killer, and that might mean he couldn't plant anything.
But if you start eliminating these acres that are sitting behind us right now, Jonathan, you know, enough of this is going to create a large enough impact that it's going to increase, it could create more shortages.
Brundick has his own idea on what waterways should make the cut.
I think that there are some that need to be. It just, the word navigable is key.
That would be rivers and lakes that can carry boat traffic. Some environmentalists say that's far too narrow.
We need to make sure that we're protecting all the waters of the United States, not just the ones that people can boat in.
Jen Pels is a biologist and attorney with the environmental group Wild Earth Guardians. She says it may be tempting to exclude a ditch that's dry 11 months out of the year in the waters of the United States definition, but it's still a critical part of the bigger water system.
And then that 1 month out of the year, those chemicals or whatever they are that are in, it gets dumped, gets washed down by a big storm event into a creek that gets washed into a perennial waterway, which gets washed into a bigger river, then you have a water quality problem.
Pels wants to go back to the Obama administration's rules. Better yet, she says, include even more creeks, streams, and tributaries. She's also concerned the Biden administration may be too willing to compromise with big ag. But some environmentalists are willing to seek middle ground. Jim Karpowitz with the Missouri Coalition for the Environment says perfect can't be the enemy of good.
As an environmentalist, I'd like to be sort of on the practical side of the fence and be able to take steps that can get done in order to initiate them immediately.
David Aiken, a professor of agricultural economics at the University of Nebraska, says don't count on a compromise.
I don't know that they can, that there's a needle or thread that would avoid all court challenges. This is just such a controversial issue. It's going to end up before the Supreme Court ultimately.
The Trump reversal of the Obama rules did end up in court. The result tilted more to what Trump wanted than what Obama imposed. Now Aiken says it's up to Congress to clarify things. Chris Brundick wants that too.
We never know with clarity what the rule is, and we need something permanent, and we need Congress to do this, but it's just not a topic they want to pick up.
In the meantime, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the Army Corps of Engineers are planning a series of virtual roundtables in December and January on what the rules should be on what makes something a water of the United States. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
The number of students at Illinois community colleges has gone down slightly, but not as much as last year. That also applies to fall enrollment at Black Hawk College in the Quad Cities and Carl Sandburg College in Galesburg. Michelle O'Neill reports those two colleges are keeping an eye on trends in higher education and the job market.
Heather Bjorgen, Dean of Enrollment Management at Black Hawk College, says 3,700 students attend classes in Moline, Kewaunee, and online.
Black Hawk College is down 0.2% compared to last year, which was fall of 2020. Over the last decade, we've seen a trajectory of enrollment decline. And this is in line with the public community college sector overall in the U.S. The enrollment declines that community colleges have experienced are likely going to be with us a little longer. Our dramatic drop in enrollment at Black Hawk College was between fall of 19 and fall of 2020. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, many of our students struggled with, you know, balancing jobs and family obligations, finding childcare, experiencing the turbulent changes in their employment settings. And so our decline between that year was down about 16% from fall of 19 to fall 2020.
Not as many adults are enrolled at Black Hawk this year.
Higher wages and more jobs being available right now, unemployment rate dropping, that has skewed that number because a lot of the folks who are adults are just out and working in the workforce and not attending college right now.
We'll have to wait and see how the pandemic affects community college enrollment and the job market. But Bjorgen says higher education is already in for a very big challenge in just a few years.
Nationwide, in the Midwest, and specifically Illinois, the number of 18 to 24-year-olds is going to decrease over the next 16 years or so that we're projecting out. And so that cliff is coming after the high school graduates of spring 2025. And so if you think back 18 years before that point, that was the economic recession between 2007 and 2009. And that's when the birth rate dropped. And so it's within our, you know, conversations right now to figure out, you know, how do we integrate learning so that employees are not forgoing those higher wages in order to upskill. And that's one of the biggest pieces for us to figure out right now.
Dr. Seamus Riley is the president of Carl Sandburg College in Galesburg. He says enrollment from last fall is down 3.9% with nearly 1,700 students attending classes in person and online.
Community colleges are a little bit insulated from the cliff that the 4 years worry about because our population tends to be more diverse. So we are, in fact, as new students to Sandburg, we were up this year 15%. And we're up 6%, 7% in dual credit career technical education, and we're up 10% in our AAS programs. And those are tend to be workforce programs. So it seems like we are seeing more students who are choosing to come and get those kind of technical skills, those applied associate degrees, which will lead directly to employment. On the other side, as everybody is experiencing this, even in the K-12 system, we have a lot more employment opportunities and a lot more people can go straight in the workforce right now, sometimes in the service industries or in working at the local grocery store and make $15, $16 an hour starting. Those are very high wages compared to what you may start off in other sectors. So we're finding more people are staying in the workforce or adding an additional job, and that does impact our numbers.
Last year, by necessity, both Sandberg and Blackhawk increased the number of online courses they offer. Riley says that flexibility creates more work for professors.
But it's difficult, and it's difficult for faculty. It's incredibly time-intensive teaching. But at the same time, it's something I think that is here to stay. I do think one of the changes that we are going to see in education, especially at the community college, is a movement away from the traditional sort of semester-based piece to more of a short-term, eight-week sort of broken-up system to allow people to come back in and out quickly, to achieve success quickly. So we're looking at some trends that are happening in terms of people being able to commit maybe for an eight-week course or a four-week course, assuming, of course, that they are prepared to do it because they can manage their lives around that education piece.
I'm Michelle O'Neill.
Fall enrollment for all the public community colleges in Illinois is down 1.5%. That's compared to a nearly 14% drop in 2020. It's been 2 months since the body of an Illinois State University student was found in the Illinois River near Peru. Police say 25-year-old Jelani Day drowned. His family says he was murdered. They say his case, like those of many Black Americans, has not gotten the attention it deserves. Eric Stock with member station WGLT has more.
Jelani Day moved downstate Normal in August to start classes at Illinois State. The Danville native was studying to become a speech pathologist. His mother, Carmen Bolden Day, says her talkative and protective son agreed to go to ISU so he could be close to home.
He wanted to go to school far away, and I talked him into coming to Bloomington, which was only 2 hours from where I was because I thought that makes him closer to me.
On August 25th, days after we got to campus, Jelani Day's family reported him missing. The following day, police in the small town of Peru, about an hour north of campus, discovered his car in a heavily wooded area. 9 days later, his body was found in the Illinois River about a mile from his car. Police said little at the time, but indicated the case didn't add up. Bloomington Police spokesperson John Furman addressed the media hours after Day's body was identified.
We can all agree that it was very suspicious, unlike him. It's just one of those of, is it foul play or not?
Authorities said nothing about the case for weeks. Carmen Bolden Day drew a contrast to Gabby Petito, a young white woman who disappeared in a case that played out on national television for weeks. Bolden Day believes police were dismissive of the case because of Jelani's race.
The fact that this is a Black male, we get a whole different perspective of how it's being handled and how it's looked at.
She says the story about him probably would have been different if he wasn't Black.
Jelani, I'm pretty sure they could have had a spin on it, and he was some boy that was out in the streets and he was gang banging or selling drugs and all this kind of stuff. The narrative would have been different.
Police silence about Day's death caused the family to wonder how hard authorities were investigating. That silence also fueled speculation about what might have happened to Day. The LaSalle County Coroner had to refute rumors. In some cases, Carmen Bolden Day had to set the record straight with what little information she had. Frustrated by the lack of police response, the Day family reached out to Reverend Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Push Coalition.
So Jelani raises several questions about Black males in education. Whether it's Trayvon Martin, or whether it's George Floyd, whether it's Jelani, but Black men keep getting killed.
Jackson made several appearances with the Day's family, including at the funeral in downstate Danville. There, Jackson compared the death to the lynching of Emmett Till, the Black teen whose murdered body was pulled from a river in 1955. Jackson also led a rally on the Illinois State campus where he called for the FBI to take over the investigation.
Local investigators cannot be trusted with this. We need.
Peru's police chief says he asked the FBI to take over the investigation. The federal agency has said it would assist, but that's it. The tensions reached a breaking point in late October when the LaSalle County coroner officially ruled Day had drowned. The coroner also said there is no evidence of other trauma, but that the body was so badly decomposed, a thorough examination was difficult, and authorities still don't know how Day ended up in the river. Carmen Bolden Day called the coroner's report an insult. She insisted someone put Day in the river against his will.
Jelani was an avid swimmer, and an avid swimmer doesn't drown himself. Jelani didn't have depression or mental issues.
Justice for Jelani!
Justice for Jelani!
In recent weeks, Day's family, along with Reverend Jackson and dozens of others, have marched through the streets of Peru and visited the river near where Day's body was found. They continue to demand answers, answers that may never come. I'm Eric Stock.
During the pandemic, drug overdose deaths in the U.S. spiked nearly 30%, reaching the highest level ever recorded. Public health experts point to one major cause, the synthetic opioid fentanyl. Side Effects Public Media's Sebastian Martinez Valdivia looks at one city's efforts to raise awareness and save lives.
If you can't tell, I'm uncomfortable.
It's a Tuesday night, and around 100 community members have gathered in the cafeteria of Hickman High School in Columbia, Missouri. The audience is listening to Willie McCurry, who spent much of his life in and out of prison in St. Louis. McCurry has struggled with addiction, but he hasn't used substances for about a year.
I appreciate everybody clapping for my year, but the main topic of the night for me is Narcan, and without that, I wouldn't have that 12 months.
A year ago, he was in a transitional facility when he intentionally overdosed on fentanyl. He awoke to the captain of the facility on his chest in tears after administering naloxone, also known as Narcan, a medicine that reverses opioid overdoses.
And when I saw him, that's actually what changed me.
McCurry was nervous. It was his first time talking to a crowd this big. But after 24 years of dealing with substance abuse, he says it was important for him to share, and he's found audiences receptive.
People tend to understand. Even those that haven't struggled with addiction, they still can feel the pain, you know.
Naloxone is part of an approach to drug use known as harm reduction. The idea is if people are going to use drugs anyway, providing tools for them and others to do that more safely can help prevent deaths. In the past, opponents of harm reduction have equated it with enabling drug abuse. But there's been a significant cultural shift towards the strategy. The Columbia Police Department organized this event alongside the local health department in response to a rash of overdose deaths in the community. In the past 4 months, 14 Columbia residents have died from overdose, a majority connected with fentanyl. In addition to Narcan, the health department provides free test strips to allow people to test drugs for the presence of the synthetic opioid. Fentanyl is what brought Jim Haney out to the briefing. Haney organizes the local chapter of Narcotics Anonymous for families and friends of those struggling with or lost to substance abuse disorder. Every Wednesday night, he shows up to the local Methodist church to listen.
You know, we don't give advice. We tend to just express ourselves, and hopefully that'll help somebody else.
Haney lost his son Scott 3 years ago to a fentanyl overdose. He says Scott had struggled with substance abuse for most of his life, but had finally gotten clean for 10 months before overdosing. Haney supports harm reduction strategies, including test strips, and says his son likely didn't know he was taking fentanyl.
So what he probably thought he was buying heroin was nothing but straight fentanyl. They said it probably killed him instantly.
That's a problem, as experts say fentanyl has progressively spread into new states. So there are more people encountering it for the first time, including in stimulants like cocaine and meth. Dr. Dan Ciccaroni studies drug use, including fentanyl, at the University of California, San Francisco.
It's kind of the Wild West, you know. It's doing different things in different places.
Ciccaroni has worked with the past two presidential administrations and says the adoption of harm reduction has grown. He says it took 20 years for mainstream adoption of naloxone, and he points to the much quicker uptake of test strips as a sign of change.
The fentanyl test strips have gone from underground literally 5 years ago to being on the FDA's hit list for promotion. It shows you that harm reduction is no longer a dirty phrase.
Ciccaroni says the Biden administration has taken a progressive stance on harm reduction strategies, and he believes that approach will continue. Nevertheless, Ciccarone and others say fentanyl is here to stay. And as the drug spreads, increasing awareness will only become more critical. I'm Sebastian Martinez Valdivia, Side Effects Public Media.
There is more of Statewide ahead. Stay with us. I'm Sean Crawford, and this is Statewide. The onset of the pandemic sparked new business ventures for some people. The forced isolation of COVID-19 made one northern Illinois couple focus on a business idea that incorporates an old-fashioned way of communicating. Yvonne Booz explains.
These days, most people use social media to communicate with close friends and family. Oswego residents Lo Bannerman Dennis and her husband Stephen wanted to make connecting more intimate with the help of the U.S. Postal Service. They did this by creating a greeting card company called Positive Post Co. Dennis says when she was growing up, greeting cards were always big in her family.
I was raised in a family where you couldn't play with a gift until you wrote and sent the thank you note. Yes. And every holiday was celebrated with some kind of a tangible card. So birthdays, greeting cards, literally anything.
She says she wanted to share that feeling that she had as a young girl with everyone else. The couple has a two-year-old who turned one at the beginning of 2020. Dennis says she realized that a lot of her friends who weren't parents didn't know how to support her. One of her friends gave her a pack of cards that had encouraging words on them, and she wanted to create something similar for new parents. This was the thought before COVID-19 took over.
And then the pandemic hit, and I was like, oh, there's a bigger need here. It's not just moms and new families. There's a global need for connection and love.
Dennis calls herself a pollinator of happiness. She's a dietitian and lactation counselor who pulled the self-made title from what she calls her need to help heal people holistically. The couple started reaching out to friends and family during the beginning of the pandemic. They did this by sending photo cards of their daughter, Spud, around her birthday. Dennis says she thought they would get responses back since most people were home. Months went by, and they still weren't hearing anything. So they reached out to see why. They learned that people were more comfortable with using social media to communicate and didn't want to deal with the hassle of buying postage stamps.
So we try to create images that are happy and joyful, but also ones that are there when someone needs a hug and they're going through a harder time and you might not know the words to say. And then it's all on 100% recycled paper and the postage stamp is already on it.
The couple started with 8 designs. 2 had fun messages. Others were meant for hard times, but were sprinkled with upbeat messages. Dennis says she knows there are plenty of greeting card companies out there, but she compares them to commercial food.
When food is grown on a conventional farm or it's grown in your backyard, you can 100% taste the difference. And same thing when you cook it. You can tell when food is just microwaved or when it's cooked with love. And so that's kind of the difference I see here too.
She says the images on their notes are hand-drawn and she touches every single card that goes out. She originally outsourced an artist, but has discovered that she has a talent for drawing too. She says Positive Post Co. will continue to find other avenues that will help drive positivity and light into the world. Dennis says she carried a lot of doubt when it came to her own artistry, but she is encouraging others to drop any burdens that are holding them down.
And if you're listening and you're questioning how to show up in the world, or you have a little inkling of a business idea or even a hobby, passion, anything, please follow it. You never know where it's going to lead. There aren't any failures, even if you start something and you don't continue it.
She explains that there is always a lesson learned, which can lead to a greater purpose. I'm Yvonne Booz.
Illinois lawmakers passed a new congressional map in October to carve up the state for the next 10 years. 14 of the 17 districts heavily favor Democratic candidates. That's not surprising since Democrats dominate the legislature. But some say this partisan advantage also comes at the expense of some Illinois communities. Eric Schmid reports from the town of O'Fallon, near St. Louis.
Cars whiz by on one of O'Fallon's main north-south roads. Here on Lincoln Avenue, just south of City Hall, the road serves as the dividing line between the new 12th and 13th congressional districts. They're currently represented by Republicans Mike Bost and Rodney Davis, respectively. The new boundary only sticks to Lincoln for a few blocks before jumping west on 5th Street and then north on Oak. Don't worry if this sounds confusing. It is. In fact, when I went to O'Fallon with my reporting partner, Kelsey Landis of the Belleville News Democrat, we struggled to keep track of which district we were in.
Hang on, okay. Yes. So this is the 12th congressional district, and that's the 13th. There's a school, there's the church, there's, you know, multiple houses. I mean, it's not like we're here on one side and then on the other side there's nothing.
This is how Illinois' new congressional maps and state legislative maps treat many communities. O'Fallon Mayor Herb Roach says this kind of division doesn't help his community. The city of 32,000 will be represented in part by two people in Congress, three state senators, and four state representatives over the next decade.
This makes me feel like we don't have really somebody who represents and understands the needs of our community when we're so split.
Roach says he doesn't feel like his city will get people who will advocate for the things O'Fallon needs, considering it's one of the only Metro East communities that's growing.
Our needs are probably a lot different than a Champaign or a Springfield or somebody like that, whether it be with our water lines, with our sewer, our stormwater, our streets.
The two congressional districts O'Fallon straddles are quite large. The 13th snakes up through Springfield to Champaign, and the 12th extends east to Indiana and down to cover southern Illinois. The new 15th district also includes parts of the Metro East, and it's another big one. It spans 35 counties from Illinois' border with Missouri and Iowa all the way to Indiana. Ken Moffitt, the political science department chair at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville, says these geographically large districts can be difficult to represent.
Just physically, in terms of getting two constituents in different part of the district, much less representing them in some ways, simply because the people who live in that district are very different from each other.
Moffitt says representatives should appeal to common interests in their district, but it's hard for him to see many things that unify. He points to the new 13th district as an example.
The Urbana-Champaign area versus the Metro East, you have fundamentally different economic drivers. And then with Decatur, different still from both, and then Springfield, with a non-trivial part of the economy driven by the presence of state government.
Moffitt says this doesn't mean it's impossible, just more challenging. To Congressman Rodney Davis, it's all about how much a representative and their staff commit to engaging with the communities in their district.
You want people who are willing to get out of their office. You want people who are willing to get integrated into their communities and the communities that we serve, and is really show a willingness to go help.
The Republican from Taylorville currently represents the 13th district, but he's drawn into the new 15th. He says there can be some advantages for communities that are split up in the new congressional map.
It can be a benefit by having multiple voices in Congress advocating on your behalf, or if you have members of Congress that aren't as active, it can be a detriment.
Davis adds most people in central and southern Illinois aren't paying attention to redistricting and probably don't know it's happening. That was the case with Charlie Cook, who owns the Happy Bakery in O'Fallon. She didn't know her community had been split up until we came into her shop and showed her a map of the districts.
It seems like very cherry-picking as far as the way the representatives are choosing their demographics. If they're being split up by partisan lines or by racial lines, then that does not seem like it's provoking a lot of fair representation.
Other locals like Ellie Gillespie weren't bothered.
How does it make you feel that your city is split?
Oh, it didn't make me feel different. Because it's the same taxes.
John Greenstreet, who owns the bike surge and repair shop in O'Fallon, says people focus too much on gerrymandering. He says it's a symptom of a larger issue.
Things like term limits and some anti-corruption measures would make a whole lot more sense than even thinking about the maps. If we could focus our efforts on addressing those kind of issues, we'd see a lot more value as citizens.
Besides, at the end of the day, Greenstreet says there's got to be a split somewhere. In O'Fallon, I'm Eric Schmid.
Illinois Congressman Rodney Davis says he won't run for governor, but will instead run to retain a seat in the U.S. House in a newly drawn district. He had a conversation with Charlie Schlinker. The Taylorville Republican says it was an easy decision.
Because it was always my first choice. It's something I was open and honest with anyone who asked. My first preference was to run for re-election, looking forward to helping Republicans take the majority back in the House here in Washington, and I'm looking forward to chairing the House Administration Committee. This should not be a surprise to anyone. When the maps were signed into law and we knew it became official, I made it known that my intention was to run for re-election in the district that is now the 15th district that includes my home and my home county of Christian County.
How much different is the district in makeup than your current one?
There's a lot of my district that is very familiar with me and very familiar with what we're doing in Congress because it's been in the same media market as much of my current district. But there's a lot of population that I still represent that used to be part of the old 13th district, my current 13th district. And a lot of areas that are new up in the northwest part of Illinois are areas that I've traveled in over my career and have built relationships and friendships, so much so that we've continued to travel in those areas for a wide variety of reasons throughout my time in Congress.
Is it a safer, redder district than the current one?
It's a gerrymandered district that's substantially more Republican than what my current 13th district was drawn to be 10 years ago. Remember, the district I currently represent was drawn to elect a Democrat 10 years ago, and we've won it five straight times. I'm looking forward to working in this new area, and a lot of the current areas that I have that make up this new 15th district, too.
Many rural areas have moved in the last decade, as you noted, more conservatively. You have prided yourself on having a bipartisan approach and being centrist and have some independent organizations back that up with ratings. Will the district make it more difficult for you to be that centrist person?
Well, not at all. I've continued to maintain my core values and conservative principles. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that we can't work together on issues that positively affect our districts and our country. When it comes to agriculture, when it comes to transportation projects, there's not a Republican way or a Democrat way to solve every problem. There's a right way and a wrong way, and the best way is to find solutions that get to actually become law because they've become solutions that both sides can accept. I've got a great track record of addressing student debt issues in this country, a great track record of addressing some of our risk management programs when it comes to our farmers and our producers. And I've got a great track record of addressing our infrastructure needs in this country by getting our infrastructure reauthorizations back on track ever since I got to Congress now about 9 years ago.
You are moving up the seniority ranks in the House. If the House turns to Republican control, you would be in line for a committee chairmanship. You mentioned the House Administration Committee. For people who don't understand what that one does, why don't you unpack how important it is to the general American population?
Yeah, up until the pandemic, the House Administration Committee was a quiet committee. It's the smallest full committee in Congress. But once the pandemic hit, our job in running the House campus became part of the front lines of what was happening in America. And unfortunately for the American people, they're still locked out of the U.S. Capitol to most. And they can't come here and tour Washington, D.C. and really petition their government as their constitutional right is. I'm really looking forward to once we take the majority, once I become chairman of House Administration come January 3rd of 2023, we're going to open this campus back up to the American people. A lot of America is wide open right now, and we've got to do our best to make sure that we look at COVID and this pandemic as a risk management issue, because we're never going to get to the zero tolerance that many experts believe that we should still strive for.
Are there other committees that you would like to focus on as well?
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to being able to eventually run for chair of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, one of the largest committees in Congress. I currently serve as the ranking member of the largest subcommittee in Congress, and that's the Highways and Transit Subcommittee. I'm looking forward to chairing that subcommittee in the next Congress, too.
That's Republican Representative Rodney Davis of Taylorville. He'll run for re-election in a newly drawn district next year. He spoke with Charlie Schlinker. Thank you. That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. Join us next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. And remember, you can find our show and past episodes at nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide. And our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.